This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and we're talking about Social Security today. Our guest is Karen Holden, Professor Emerita at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs and Department of Consumer Science. She's an affiliate of the Institute for Research on Poverty and the Center for Retirement Security, of which she was the founding co-director. What do you want to know about Social Security? Do you have questions about the latest cost of living adjustment? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Karen, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, obviously, more, what is it, 93% of all Americans, I think, are participating in Social Security. What was the point of it? Wasn't it FDR who started it back
yes,
in the
Yes,
he New
started
Deal?
It. It was a consequence of the Depression mm-hmm. when there was a lot of unemployment, but also elderly workers who had no other source of income. And it was seen as a program that was really a foundation and has been a foundation for our pension and our health care system, both public and private, and it has enabled people to have a semi-secure retirement, at least some income mm-hmm. in retirement. It was never seen as enough. It was always seen as an underlying foundation for that.
It's not particularly looked at like at that at this point. Right? We're not really all looking at it. I think a lot of seniors are thinking, oh, well, when I retire, I'll have this and I'll just be fine. But they really shouldn't be.
You do not want to think that. Mm-hmm. It is based on the known fact, but the theory that if you're a higher income worker, you probably have pensions. And also because of the higher income, you are more able to save for retirement. While if you are a low income worker, you may not have a pension, you may not be able to save. And so the formula is based upon lower income workers, lower wage workers, I should say, receiving a higher percentage of their taxable wages when they mm-hmm. retire. But for them, and there are a large number of people who receive only Social Security, but you should, whether you're low or high, you should not think about Social Security as enough.
So who does qualify for Social Security then?
Well, about 90% of workers are covered by Social Security. So if you're in covered work, there are a few that are exempt. And if you are covered by Social Security, then you pay into it, or you and your employer pay into it. And if you have enough what are called quarters of coverage, which is basically 10 years of coverage when you reach your retirement age or become disabled earlier. And retirement age now is basically 67 for people who are retiring now. You will qualify for Social Security based upon your average earnings over a 35-year period. And that's okay. Another point to make is that Social Security covers is based upon your highest 35 years of earnings. So if you have 0 years in that 35, that zero is counted in, which is another reason to either be saving or be conscious of how your non-working years will affect your retirement.
Now, back in that particular time frame, most women did not work outside of the home. How was that considered when they came up with these equations on who would get what?
Well, back then, most workers, as you said, most women, as you said, were not working outside the home. And so a few years later, they did come up with spouse benefits and survivor benefits,
okay,
which were initially just for women, and it has been, which I need not go into, but there is an interesting history about how Social Security has dealt with gender equality. There was a big Supreme Court case because there was a male survivor of a woman worker, and the initial policy, because it was written that you had to be a female supported by your spouse. And he said, I'm not a woman.
Right,
I'm not.
Right.
And I was the worker, but now I'm not. And she was the worker. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, yes, Social Security has to be gender neutral. So I'm proud to say, having worked in Social Security, not as a survivor, but as not as a worker in the office, but I'm but as a researcher, and I'm proud to say that Social Security is gender neutral. You can't find any gender differences that are specifically tied to gender.
It has been able to adapt to the changing social, what's the word I want, mores, I guess, through all these years, because it's almost 100 years old.
Yes.
So lots of things have changed since then. So it has adapted, maybe slowly, but it has adapted.
Right. No, and that is one of the virtues of this program. It's the only program that has to every year come up with a report on its finances. You know, we don't do that with education. We don't do that with defense. That looks in for the next 75 years. The advantage, though, is that having a board of trustees that oversees the program every year, it does manage to look at all the provisions and see how the provisions affect both the beneficiaries and the financing.
Now, there have been some polls out there that show that the future of the Social Security program is weighing heavily on a lot of Americans. What is Social Security going to run out of money? Is that's the big question, right?
Right?
I've been hearing it since I was little, and I'm not little anymore. So,
well, Social Security is largely financed by payroll tax. So payroll tax, which now provides about 90% of the funds, will be there. The original planners of Social Security were very smart in saying you need a trust fund to manage years when payroll taxes are lower or higher, and so it has a trust fund. And that has, so when you hear about Social Security running out of money, it is because beginning very recently and currently in this year, they are drawing on the trust fund because the payroll taxes are not enough. So when they talk about, they're talking about when the trust fund is no longer there. And at that time, which is now projected to be 2035, interestingly, we have increased that by a year because our economic growth has been quite high in the last couple of years. And so the Social Security Administration has said, with that economic growth, we can that improves our finances slightly. So at when that trust fund runs out, 83% of the benefit amount will be able to be paid. And then in 75 years, it will be about 73%. So the payroll tax will always be there. And the question is, how will Social Security be adjusted so that we can pay 100% of the promised benefits? And people have come up with ways to do that.
Mm-hmm. You're right. There's different ways. Is 2035 is coming up pretty darn quick. And I think it's ironic that it's 100 years after Social Security was invented. But can we, is it up to the legislature? Is that where this is going to be fixed?
It is up to Congress.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We've got a call from Chris in Adams. Go ahead, Chris.
Good morning. I have a couple of things to say. The first is that what you just said about the fund running out is an argument for two things. Number one, the minimum wage being raised to a living wage so that people have more money in their personal accounts and the fund is funded. And number two, this problem of the, both candidates saying that people shouldn't declare tips or it won't be taxed. that means you won't have as much FICA money going into your personal account, so that if you get disabled or you retire, you won't have as much money in your fund, and you'll be living below the poverty rate, which is what I'm living on. But I want to just say something else, which is that I had the grotesque misfortune of catching a disease that was a female disease. 97% of the people in this country who have fibromyalgia are females, and it's very high in other people with different kinds of rheumatoid arthritis. And I couldn't get my disability for 13 years. Number one, you have to get an attorney, and you have to document. And I recommend that everybody send off a letter to Tammy Baldwin's office and send off a letter to Bernie Sanders' office, because this is one of his big bugaboos in the Congress. And if you want to get to the source, you've got to contact him. And the other thing I wanted to say was that Bernie also wants to raise the amount of disability that everybody gets, so that people at the bottom get, so that you have a living wage coming into your house. And that I wanted to talk about one other thing. Oh, when you inherit money from your parents dying or somebody else gives you money, the minimum or the maximum amount you can have in your bank account is $2,000. Now, my father died and I inherited a couple thousand dollars. They docked my Social Security income for a period of time to pay that money back to Social Security, to the government, so that I was living on $350 a month for 2 years.
Okay, thanks, Chris. We appreciate all of that. A lot to unpack there.
Yes.
Karen, go ahead if you want to tackle any of those
Okay,
topics.
Yes. I will tackle each of them at least briefly.
Okay.
The last one about, I think the caller must be on supplemental security income, because that is the means-tested program for disabled and low-income, blind and disabled and low-income elderly. And there is an asset test that would be affected by somebody's inheritance. Social Security does not do any testing. It is only based upon what your covered earnings were during your highest 35 years of earnings. But she mentioned several important things. The minimum wage, Social Security doesn't take any stance on that, nor will I. But yes, if you increase wages, covered wages, you're going to see more income coming into the Social Security system. That's true of increasing any work. Covered work will increase and that's why economic growth is not a solution, but it's a help. The tips is very interesting, because she is right. When tips are taxed for Social Security, that is income into the trust fund. And non-taxing tips will reduce the revenue into the trust fund and will reduce the covered earnings. So when those individuals go to get their benefits, it will be lower because their tips were not declared as part of their covered wages. So that is an interesting issue. She and let me bring up one other related issue that has come in the national discussion, and that is about taxing Social Security. Social Security benefits are taxed. Now about 40% of beneficiaries earn enough taxable income that their benefits are taxed based upon their adjusted gross income.
Okay, let's take that one apart a little bit.
Okay,
that was a lot of information there.
Well,
let's take first a little bit of a break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about that.
All right.
Our guest today is Karen Holden. She's a professor emerita at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs and Department of Consumer Science. Give us a call with your Social Security questions at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is a Larry Mueller Show coming up at noon. Stay tuned for the weather guys. They're going to be back to talk about our warm fall weather and also a little bit about climate change challenges. Hope you can stay with us. Right now, it's Social Security, and, you know, it's complicated, Karen. So we were talking about taxes and Social Security. So when you just look at it over the top, it's like, well, if the government's giving me money, why should I give any money back to them? That doesn't make any sense. So explain what happens, please. So anyway, we're talking about Social Security taxes. So if you could just explain why, if we get government money, we have to pay taxes back. What doesn't kind of make sense. So why?
The taxing for up until 1983, Social Security benefits were not taxed. Then in 1983, under Reagan, we were facing a similar crisis, and Alan Greenspan, who was then Secretary of the Treasury, was head of a commission that looked at several ways in which to put Social Security back in a healthy position. And they did, quote, solve it for that period. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they said was Social Security is an income. At that time, half of it was not ever taxed because it was employer. The employers contributed 50%, which was not included in the person's income. And so it seemed reasonable that higher, as your income got higher and higher, that these benefits could be taxed, just like, you know, federal workers' wages are taxed, just even though they are receiving benefits from the government. So it just became part of taxable income. But they set it to be above a certain threshold. So only if your adjusted gross income is above a certain threshold is 50% of your income, so your benefits taxed. And then when it reaches another threshold, 80% of them are taxed. And people may not realize that that money goes into the Social Security Trust Fund. It is not just going to the U.S. Treasury to finance other programs. It is going explicitly into the trust fund. So if those benefits are not taxed, that accounts for about 3-4% of the Social Security revenue. So if that's not taxed, that would be another hit on mm-hmm. On our finances.
Okay. So a lot of people will get their Social Security, but then they will continue to work part-time or have other income. How does that affect Social Security and taxes that they pay?
Well, if they are below their full retirement age, they will be taxed on that amount. There's an exempt amount that they can earn, and then above that, their benefits are reduced. And likewise, that goes into the trust fund. Mm-hmm. Well, it is in the trust fund because they're not receiving those benefits then.
Okay. We've got a question from Ken in Madison. Go right ahead, Ken.
Hi. My question is in regard to the taxation income levels for the Social Security wages that are taxed. My understanding is those thresholds have never been adjusted for inflation, and I'm asking why that is the case and if that can be changed. And my understanding also is this 85% of one's wages are taxed when they reach a certain income level, not 80%. Thank you.
Well, I stand corrected if it's 85%. They are not adjusted, and that would be one of the proposals that would be considered if they're hopefully there. I think the consensus is that hopefully in the next administration there will be a commission that will sit down and think about the various ways. There's no one single way to solve this problem, but there are many proposals that have been a combination of proposals that have been introduced by members of Congress. And estimated out the cost estimated out by the chief actuary. So there are a lot of proposals out there, and one would be considering raising that threshold.
Okay, thank you, Ken. Joe in Wisconsin Dells, you're next. Go right ahead.
Yeah, two questions. One, what of our wages, of the money we get paid, is taxed by Social Security? I know that wages are, salaries are. Does commission, does stock options, does stuff like that get considered as far as Social Security goes?
It is just your covered wages, the wages you receive. And it is your tax, unless it's part of your specifically your wage, it is not, those items are not taxed.
Okay. And your second question, Joe?
My second question, just an idea, as far as funding Social Security, I know there's a level above which wages are not subject to Social Security tax, $165,000, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me if we just eliminate that and Social Security tax all of everybody's wages and salary, that this would fund it.
It's not clear it would fund it completely, but one of the very serious proposals is to raise that tax. Interestingly enough, when the program went into effect, and as recently as 1977, about 90% of wages were covered by the Social Security laws, and now it's down to 83% because our growth in earnings have been above. We've had very unequal growth in earnings, and as that has progressed, the covered earnings, it becomes a lower and lower percentage. So one of the very serious proposals, which I suspect we'll see, is that we raise that cap to at least 90% of covered earnings. And that would have an effect because only about 6% at any one time earn above those earnings. But 20% of people at some time during their work career do have incomes above those earnings. So it would be a significant change. The problem with uncapping it entirely is that you still have to provide benefits. It's hard to say, oh, you're going to be taxed on your earnings, but you won't get any benefit for it. So most of the, and we have a progressive benefit, and some of the proposals are, oh, we'll increase their benefits by 5% of that next little piece of their earnings. But if you start taxing millions of dollars in earnings, you end up by paying a lot of benefits to high earners.
Okay.
So that kind of presents a limit to
sure.
how high you want your your tax. But you're absolutely right. That is estimated to solve about a third of the gap if we raise it to 90%.
Has the problem been that we just haven't really taken the time to look at Social Security? Does it kind of get pushed down the road, and now we finally come to the end of the road where we really do have to take a look at it?
Right. We have not taken a serious look at it since 1983, and people are saying now is the time to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I will also mention that one of the problems with the earnings is that we have had more and more of our earnings be non-wage, like as our health insurance costs have risen, health insurance becomes a greater proportion of people's wages, and those are not taxed. So one of the issues is how do we deal with non-taxed benefits? Should we? But that is a question.
Yeah, a lot of things to unpack there for sure. Well, we always have yearly, there is a cost of living adjustment, correct? COLA, for people who receive Social Security. And how is that decided upon?
Okay. Technically, it's an inflation adjustment. And that is every year, Social Security looks at the increase in prices, which is based upon a fixed basket of goods that the Bureau of Labor Statistics has determined is a basket of goods that in the Social Security case is purchased by average consumers in urban areas, 30% of whom are wage workers, or they have to get at least 30% of their income from wages. So it's a wage, urban-based cost of living. I won't go into the details why, but and that is adjusted, looked at every year, that same basket of goods, to see how the prices of that basket of goods is increased. And that is what the Social Security Administration uses to adjust our wages. Look at from one, they look at the third quarter in one year to the next third quarter, and that, and then in December they announce what the increase is, and this year it'll be 2.5%. I make a distinction between inflation and cost of living, because cost of living can change because you adjust. If beef goes up in price, you substitute chicken for it, and that is not taken into account in this price index.
So they're using something that's a little bit more tangible. Right.
Right.
But does it cover our day-to-day costs? I mean, are people being left behind because of this?
Well, there are two things. One is, if your basket of goods doesn't conform with the Bureau of Labor Statistics basket of goods, the inflation rate you're experiencing may be higher, or it could be lower. It is also a basket of goods that is represented by this particular group of workers. So if you have a different budget and you have more food and fewer medical expenses, then you may have experienced less inflation if medical expenses are going higher. So it may not represent exactly what your basket of goods looks like. And then, of course, if you have, this is just an adjustment to one source of income, to Social Security. So if you have income from a pension that is not rising, then your income will not rise by that inflation adjustment. So this is just an attempt, and it's consistent with Social Security's philosophy, is they're trying to secure income across the board on a progressive basis, but try and keep consumption of essential items possible.
Mm-hmm. And I'm certain that would vary a lot depending on the part of the country where you live. How is that taken into consideration?
No, that's not taken into account, except in what's called weighting. You know, this is a national survey of consumers and where they purchase their goods. And so they, so if you're in a high inflation rate, yes, that might be an underestimate of the inflation. You know, this is a national program, and you try to accomplish your objectives nationally.
Sure. And you said it was going to be 2.5,
mm-hmm.
and you'll see that in a check in
January. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I believe that inflation is starting to go down. So is that less than it has been, like the year before that?
Last year it was high.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a couple years before that where there was no inflation adjustment, because I frankly can't remember what the adjustment has to be in order to, but then it's cumulative. So.
Okay. So it's not like if we had deflation, they would take money away.
That is not in the law.
Okay.
Right. Social Security is, you know, Social Security, it's a national program. It's not means tested. And the administration costs about half a percentage of the total revenue. So it is a relatively inexpensive program to run, because they're not worried about, well, you in Madison may or have less of an inflation, so we're going to give you less, and Milwaukee, we're going to give you more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that could be a nightmare for sure. For sure.
Right.
What was I going to ask you about? We were going to talk about what is the basic? So how old do you have to be to get Social Security, to apply for it?
Well, For retirement, you can apply for it at 62.
62. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then that's reduced as from your full retirement age.
Okay.
But if you're disabled, you can apply earlier.
Mm-hmm. And so if you, depending on the year you were born, your mm-hmm. full Social Security is at different ages. So if someone was born like 1960, then they have to wait until they're 67 to get full Social Security. Is that
and
right?
That is the max. That was an adjustment made in 1983 mm-hmm. in order to solve the crisis that we were facing then. And there are proposals to increase the full retirement age. That's a little more controversial because at 67, you are entering high death rates and high disability rates. And so people are arguing that changing full was from 67 to 69 is different from 65 to 67.
Mm-hmm. We have a question from Norm in Wausau. Go ahead, Norm.
Hi, thanks for answering. Say, would you happen to know, I know that in the state of Wisconsin, Social Security retirement is not taxable income. Do you know if Social Security disability is taxable income?
I think Social Security is taxable in Wisconsin, but I may be wrong about that. I haven't noticed that on my income tax.
Well, next time we have our tax expert, Mary Mellum, in, we'll have to ask her that question.
Right, I think disability is a program of the Social Security Administration, and so those are your benefits from Social Security as well.
Mm-hmm. So where can Norm go to find that answer?
Go to there is a www.ssa.gov.
So Social Security Administration, so SSA.gov.
Right.
And make sure they have the .gov so you're not going to some fake website,
right,
too.
Right. And they have a lot of information on benefits. You can also set up your own account, and there you can find your taxed wages, which is very important for individuals who are still working to make sure that all their wages have been reported. If you're a beneficiary, you can get a duplicate a duplicate Social Security card. You can look at your benefits. You can get your taxable reports from there. So there is also one on Medicare, medicare.gov. That similarly, you can, and through these, you can apply for the benefits when you are eligible and find out when you are eligible. It really, both of those are really marvelous sites.
Mm-hmm. Lots of details on there. That was going to be my next question. So, you know, you're 65 and you're like, you know what, I think I'm going to go ahead and get my Social Security. Is that the first place that you go?
That would be the first place, mm-hmm. right? In fact, when you call the local Social Security office, that's where they send you. First
okay.
to find out your, and then you can perhaps go down and to the local office.
And how many do we have in Wisconsin? Do you know? Are they pretty much all the major cities?
I believe so. We have one here.
Mm-hmm. We did, Jeff, our technical director, Jeff Robbins, did say that SSA disability is not taxable in Wisconsin. So he looked that up, and according
to
the internet. So thank you, Jeff. Appreciate that. So Bill just emailed us, and he said he studied under Professor Jim Hickman at UW-Madison mm-hmm. in the late 80s. And at the time, the biggest concern for the trust fund were the impending drain from the baby boomers and an expected reduction in the taxable workforce. How have the workforce projections panned out, and how big of an impact has increased longevity leading to increased morbidity impacted the trust fund?
The estimates are, let me answer the first part, the last part first. The estimates are that longevity has not impacted much because at the same time we have had a lengthening of work life. And if those tend to be high income years, so that hasn't affected the trust fund a lot. The baby boomers were sort of a surprise to the Social Security estimates early on, which were made early on. The issue now is, and the big one that is affecting the trust fund, is our lower fertility rate. The baby boomers are now retiring and will continue to retire. And after they retire, after they die, sorry for you baby boomers out there, the trust fund will improve. But the Social Security Administration is now estimating that our fertility rate will go, total fertility rate will go down from 2, which is replacement, to 1.9. Which so that will affect the number of beneficiaries to taxpayers.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. There have been, and like I said, not to get political here because that's not what we do, but there have been some accusations out there that people who are maybe undocumented are getting Social Security benefits. What is out there to stop that from happening?
Well, first of all, it is now very hard to get a Social Security number if you are not a citizen or a resident. If you are and if you are not basically, if you're not legally documented to work for those reasons, if you are have to receive a Social Security number for some reason, the Social Security Administration works very closely with the Department of Homeland Security to make sure that the documentations they have about a worker is consistent with what DHS has on that worker. So when you go to a Social Security office and ask for a Social Security number, you have to provide all these documentations that you are a legal resident. Mm-hmm. Social Security issues those numbers, so you can't make up a number and go and get your benefits, because if you had a fake number for some reason and you went to the Social Security office, they would say, this is not an on number. Sorry, you can't. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Social Security Fund receives a lot of income from undocumented workers working because for some reason their earnings are reported. You know, the employer doesn't have to check with the Social Security office to make sure they have a legal number. And that will go into the Social Security Fund. And there is a fund that is undocumented worker fund, which helps finance. So they provide about $10 billion in revenue to the Social Security, but it would be very, very difficult for anybody to get benefits if they did not have a legal number that was theirs, because mm-hmm. Social Security has their documentation. They know our dates of birth.
So lots of safeguards there.
Oh, there are lots. Yeah. And they have increased over time. So I think it's undocumented. And if Social Security finds an undocumented worker working, legally they're supposed to report them to DHS. So in fact, the incentives are for an undocumented worker not to try and get benefits because they would be reported to DHS.
Okay. We've got Stella in Sturgeon Bay with a question next. Go ahead, Stella.
One logical solution would be to change the income that is subject to the FICA taxes and to include stock options and capital gains above a threshold of, you know, a high threshold in order to capture the income that people like hedge fund owners and high executives in large corporations get that's income, but it's not considered income for FICA for taxing for Social Security purposes. So we could get a lot more income if we tax everything that is actually income for the people who are capturing most of the income in the country.
Yes, that would solve it in terms of revenue, perhaps. But I think it's important to always keep in mind that this was an earnings-based system. This was an insurance system for wage loss, and not for loss of other kinds of income. I think your question really touches on the whole question of what income should be taxed in general, because those incomes are differently treated in our general tax system, our general income tax system. So if people sat down and considered that, I'm sure there would be some impact on Social Security. But I think it's very important to understand that Social Security is a broadly supported program because it is very focused on earnings. And there is a great deal of worry that if we broaden the taxing of it and not the beneficiary status of it, that it would lose support, and therefore there would be we would be in more difficult problem as higher income people didn't support it at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so much to consider. We're talking about Social Security with Karen Holden, Professor Emerita at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs and Department of Consumer Science. Do you have a question? We still have time to take it. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Make sure you tune in tomorrow. We're going to be talking about growing and carving pumpkins. And then we're going to talk about foreign language. What are the benefits of learning one, and what are the best ways to do it? That's tomorrow, starting at 11. Right now, we're talking about Social Security. And Karen, we did get a couple of emails. Mark in Rhinelander is wondering if there's a benefit bonus for veterans. And if there is, can you explain it?
I am sorry. I do not know that. I know that Social Security integrates with federal workers and the veteran fund and railroad retirement. But I'm sorry. I don't go to ssa.gov and look that up.
Yep, and like we said earlier, it's a great site, so I'm sure you can find that out. Vivian in Green Bay called to ask how the money in Social Security Trust Fund is invested.
It is invested in what are special issue treasury bonds that the treasury issues specifically for Social Security. And the whole idea is that this is backed by the full faith and credit of the United States and is there when it is needed.
Okay. Thank you for that. And if you've got a call or a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So we've heard about Social Security Administration kind of nightmare scenarios where, you know, maybe you don't get your benefits on time, or there's long waits, they're short-staffed. Is this being addressed?
Well, they are certainly short-staffed, and ironically, even though Social Security pays for its administration out of its benefits, how much it can spend on administration is controlled by Congress, and that has been cut back over time. So it is, luckily, we're in a era of more online information, and SSA has and Medicare have come up to that.
Mm-hmm.
But there are still some offices you can go to.
Okay, sounds good. And again, ssa.gov is where you want to go to get some answers for those questions, in particular if we can't get to all of the callers today. We do have... let's see, we've got a couple of callers here. Before we get them on the line, Karen... Oh, there, Carol in Crandon is available. Go ahead, Karen. Go ahead. Go right ahead.
Hi. I recently received a letter from the Social Security Administration, and they said for my new amount, it will be $1,028.50, and I was receiving receiving. I'm still receiving 932. I'm wondering, since I've been divorced for many years, it said the amount we pay on your spouse's record will be decreased to $79 since they increased the amount we paid on your own record. I wonder why they are reducing my spouse's record.
Okay, thank you, Carol. Can you comment on that, Karen?
Well, of course, I don't know the specifics of your own situation. Under Social Security, one can be eligible for both their own and what's called an auxiliary benefit based upon a divorced or current spouse. And Social Security pays the higher of one or the other. So they could, for some reason, have reduced your spouse benefit, but if your own is higher, they will be paying that. So that might be what they're talking about, is that if you're what's called a dual beneficiary, it's important for you to know which one you're actually getting or how one is being supplemented by the other.
So this is definitely somebody who should be giving a call to Social Security.
Right, or just go on and...
Yeah, so good luck with that, Carol. Let's go to John in Sun Prairie. Go ahead, John.
Yes, I was just wondering, if a person takes their Social Security at age 63, does it part of it become taxable, or is it all taxable? And do you lose some of it each year because you took it early until you get to a later year towards your FRA?
The benefit will remain the same. So when you take your benefit before your full retirement age, it will be reduced for the rest of your life. And it will be taxable based upon your gross income. And that's an annual determination.
Okay. Thank you, John, for that question. Jake in Madison. Go right ahead.
Hello. I missed a detail of what you were talking about earlier with people without Social Security numbers contributing to the Social Security pot. How does that happen when they don't have a number?
They would have given a made-up number to their employer. They might have found, for example, a deceased worker's number is possible, and the employer wouldn't know whether that was a real number or not, and would just report it to the Social Security Administration. And the Social Security Administration would have no live matching person, and so it would just go into the sort of the lost person fund.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of a interesting situation when that happens, because the employers are just paying it because it goes through all their records, right?
Right.
But there's no real person that's going to get the benefit of that. So
right. Or the person could have said, well, I've applied for a Social Security number. Mm-hmm. And it used to be, actually, that people, when they got a Social Security number, could go back to the Social Security Administration and say, well, here's my proof that I was working and contributing. But the Social Security does not do that now. There's no retrospective.
Okay. Well, thank you all for your calls. And Karen, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate you sharing your knowledge with us. Karen Holden is a professor emerita at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs and Department of Consumer Science. She's an affiliate of the Institute of Research on Poverty and the Center for the Health and Demography of Aging. She's also an affiliate of the Center for Retirement Security. Thank you all for listening. And coming up are the weather guys. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. The weather guys are back with us today. Steve Ackerman is the former Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. He's also an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And John Martin is a professor and former chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And we'd like to hear from you. What weather questions or observations would you like to talk about? Give us a call. 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, Steve, it's good to see you. John is a little AWOL.
Yeah, he'll be here, I'm sure.
He'll be here
teaching
later.
Class. This is the thing with people who have real jobs.
That's right. Said as a true retiree.
Right.
I love it. So I think the thing that's on most people's minds is, it's almost December and tomorrow's going to be like 80 degrees. What's going on?
Yeah, October's been a dry and warm month in general. It's not uncommon to have this, although it's not common either. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we had, last week we had some frost around town. I'm an outside of town.
Yeah.
And yeah, later on this week, it's going to get up in the 70s for sure. And it's going to be, on Wednesday or so, it'll be stormy and rainy. Mm-hmm. But then it goes back into the warm. It's just part of the extremes that we're seeing as we warm up as a globe as well. Those warm extremes are going to get warmer. And that's part of the variability that we're seeing as well.
I like it in the fall and the spring. I'm not sure I'm going to like it in the summer, but
I don't like it in the summer. And the humidity in the summer also adds to the uncomfort. But right now, blue skies, beautiful. The leaves are really, in some areas, are really peaking right now. And so it's really nice to get out.
Depending on where you live. I'm down here in the south end of Wisconsin. It's beautiful.
There are some really gorgeous trees out there right now. Yep. Yeah, we were up north a little earlier in the week. And a lot of that is already
Hit the ground.
Yeah.
But it's gorgeous. We did get an email from Krista earlier. She called to ask how unusual it is to have such visible northern lights as we've seen recently, because there's been all kinds of alerts and they were amazing.
Unfortunately, it's not unfortunate because we were further south, but hiking in the Arches and Badlands and things like that. So it was beautiful down there. But the Northern Lights didn't get there. And it is odd to be seeing such beautiful displays in southern Wisconsin as we've been seeing. There's a couple of things that go along with that. What causes these gorgeous northern lights to reach this far are mass ejections of the sun, the corona mass ejections. And those are occurring frequently. It's just a question of, does it hit Earth? And so the sun, in terms of its activity, goes through an 11-year cycle or a 22-year cycle to complete it. And it's coming out of an active year. It's just reached its peak when we had the solar eclipse a couple of years ago.
Okay.
So it's still near its peak in activity.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, does that corona mass injection hit Earth or not? And a lot of times, you get the alert that it's happening and you get your fingers crossed that it's going to hit us, and it doesn't. And so you don't have it. This past cycle was, we got some really gorgeous.
And I tried really hard to go and find it. I don't know what it was. I just have some kind of a doom cloud over my head or something. All these people were taking these beautiful pictures and I'm outside looking and I couldn't find any. So when we have these, is it pretty spotty?
It can be spotty, but not so much because it is a big event.
Okay.
Geographically, longitudinally, it can be a really big event. The question is, one, is it cloudy or not? Because it is, even though the pictures look gorgeous, it is faint still, right? And you got to think about how they're taking the pictures. They probably have their shutter open for a while in order to intensify it.
Very true.
And then the other thing is, are you out there at the right time? So a lot of times you'll go out there at midnight and it won't really hit until 1 a.m.
Yeah.
And if you fall asleep in your lounge chair, you're going to miss it.
Unless that mosquito bites you.
True. Right. Yeah.
So those little, I keep getting notifications from, I don't remember even who, telling me, what time it's going to be. You can see these northern lights or what have you. Are those pretty accurate?
They are. What I subscribe to is, it's the Space Association. It's a government agency. I forget what it is, but I get emails as well when there's a mass ejection. So as soon as they observe the sun sending out another corona mass ejection, you know, they send out an alert and they tell you if it's minor, major, or in between, and what the probability if it's going to hit Earth. So that's what I subscribe to. And if it's a major one with a high probability, then I pay attention. I'm sure there are other sites that give you the timing and things like that, but I don't subscribe to those.
Okay, I see a map, and it's the globe, and it just, you know, has the colors about where it'll be covering.
And that's where, again, when I get that message that there's a major one, then I'll start looking, okay, is it going to hit northern Wisconsin, or does it look like it's going to come down here? And then I'll follow up.
So we did kind of get off on that, so thank you for the question.
Well, it's space weather. It's still weather.
But we want to talk about, of course, we're talking about the warm fall, but it's been so dry, too. Now, you said we're going to... I see the predictions too. We're going to get a little rain this week. But what about the next few weeks? Are we just in one of those cycles where it's dry?
It certainly seems that way. I haven't looked out beyond into November to see what's going on in November. I've been more focusing in October, where we have been a really dry spell. I'm part of this COCORAS, which is a community that makes observations of rainfall at home. And I'd say probably 20 days in October, we didn't have any precipitation. There was one day where I had 4 inches early on in October, but ever since then, it's been at most a tenth of an inch or a trace, but not, it's been just dry.
It has.
And you can see it when you go outside.
Oh, yeah. I can't believe I'm still watering flowers the end of October. I'm not complaining about that.
I'm not happy about that either. and we had this prediction of a little bit of rain a couple of days ago, which was great. But the ground was so dry that I actually watered our flowers as well in order to make it susceptible so that that little bit of rain we had absorbed.
Exactly. Are we setting any records? Do you know?
Oh, that is a good question that I should have looked up for October. except for that really big day where we had a few inches across the state, I would think that probably is keeping us from being one of the record precipitations in October.
Because that was kind of a big dump. So.
That was just a big dump, right? Yeah, I know. You know, most places in southern Wisconsin got around 1.5 to 2 inches. Our house was one of those areas where we got 4 inches of rain.
According to our producer Joel here, State Climatology Office says that by the end of September, 16% of the state, including northern and south central Wisconsin, will experience moderate drought conditions.
That I believe.
And it's probably gotten worse.
And it's gotten worse. Yeah. Now, what that is in terms of the driest or not, I don't know where it ranks, but we're definitely in a drought situation.
Yeah. What is that going to mean if we don't have a wet winter?
I mean, you'll be watering your flowers even more.
Right? Well, I could have figured that out, Steve. Does that usually mean if we've got all this dry, 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 is that going to continue for a while?
It depends on the kind of cycle that we get into.
Okay.
And so in the wintertime, you know, we could really wipe this out with, again, a couple of really good winter storms, which are not uncommon in Wisconsin.
Yeah, they could happen anytime.
We certainly have experienced that.
Yes, we have. Yeah. Yes, we have.
And I think the real danger, again, we can water our plants to some degrees, unless it's a real severe drought, then we shouldn't. But the key will be in forests and the prairie lands. They'll be dry and therefore really susceptible to fires.
And we did have a winter last year with not a lot of precipitation.
We did, that's right, which helped lead to the dry. It made it up in the spring and early summer. We're back in that dry period.
Back in that again. What about winter forecasts? Have you seen anything? Do we have an El Nino?
I haven't looked at it. It's not, I don't like to go too far out. I mean, the forecasts are getting really good
now.
But I kind of still head, I don't want to be looking at December or January yet in terms of what it's looking like.
Right, right. Well, if John was here, we could ask him what the Farmer's Almanac says. For those who don't know, John does not like the Farmer's Almanac prediction. So.
They'll tell you whatever they said opposite.
To be stubborn about it. So, we're joined today by Steve Ackerman, an emeritus professor of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. If you've got a question about the weather or have an observation, give us a call. Lines are open, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. Hope you can join us tomorrow. We're going to be talking about growing pumpkins, big ones, little ones, the ones in between, and also carving them with a master carver. And then in the second hour, we're going to hear about the best ways to learn a foreign language. So that's tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, starting at 11. Right now, it is weather time. So we're talking to John, well, actually to Steve. John is on his way, we assume. So we assume he'll be getting here at some point. But either way, we can handle this, Steve. So, you know, you guys write this really great column. Is it weekly? Did you write the column?
It is. Okay. We've been doing it weekly since 2011 or something.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, it's called Ask the Weather Guys, appropriately enough, and it's a Wisconsin State Journal. But a couple of weeks ago, your column answered the question about quotation marks, really controlling the weather, and who is they in that question?
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of conspiracy theories out there right now.
About everything.
We had a representative from another state claim that we are controlling the weather, which is just it's just baloney. I mean, we can't. We are impacting climate. But again, that is something that has been occurring for many, many years through slow changes in the chemical composition of the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. There is so much energy associated with a storm that we just don't have that kind of energy, even if we knew how to control the weather. So, no, we cannot control the weather. If we did, we wouldn't really be in a dry drought condition in Wisconsin. We're not evil people who are trying to control the world.
No, not at all.
It's unfortunate that people think that.
But it really is unfortunate. I'm sorry, I lost my place here. Healing the ozone hole. So we were talking about that in the promo about. Okay, I thought the ozone hole had been closed. So apparently I have not been up to date on this. What's going on with that?
So it's getting better, for sure. And again, this is one of those examples where unintentionally we're changing the environment chemically through CFCs that are very stable chemicals that we were using in refrigeration back in the 60s and 70s. And back in the 70s, it was discovered that they were very stable compounds, that they would make it up to the stratosphere where the ozone was, and then break apart and interact with the oxygen atoms and prevent the formation of ozone, or on the other hand, destroy the ozone shield up there, which protects us from ultraviolet radiation from the sun. Which, if you have fair skin, you know that that's a problem in terms of skin cancer and things like that. Mm-hmm. So that was back in the 70s. Again, there was a lot of discussion about what to do and could we do nothing. There was a lot of opposition to changing that because whether or not it was really the situation, et cetera. But eventually, the scientific evidence came through to demonstrate, yes, it is the CFCs. We began to change and make rules about using CFCs and finding other ways to cool refrigerants than using CFCs. And as a result, the ozone hole, as it was developing, is now slowing down. And so we're seeing the amount of ozone up in the stratosphere recuperating from those days.
So about that same time, people were talking about aerosols.
Yes.
Did that have an effect on the ozone too?
So part of that was also the aerosols finding their way up into the stratosphere, mm-hmm. and leading to a global cooling, again, because of the stability. And so they would reflect solar energy out. In fact, I think that may have been one of the things people were proposing in order to deal with the destruction of the ozone. And actually, people are now also proposing that in order to offset global warming. But that aside, that was another big thing in the 70s of how we deal with those aerosol sprays, mm-hmm. some of which had CFCs in them as well.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I can kind of go back to using all that hairspray now.
And part of that is, you know, they changed how they do that activity. And, you know, there's always going to be unexpected consequences of what we're doing, that we're just, you know, ignorant of how something potentially works. And the key, I think, in this situations with CFC in the ozone hole is that we discovered the scientific evidence pointed to this is what's happening. And because of that, then socially and through regulations, we can deal with it, mm-hmm. and fix it. And it's the same thing with global warming. We know what's doing it. It's carbon emissions. And so the scientific evidence is there. We can't control the weather, but we can control how much carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere or take out of the atmosphere. And that again, is going to take social responsibility to do that.
Sure. And it's a different time politically.
It's a very different time politically.
And if we had had the problem that we do now, back then, we might even have a bigger problem.
Ozone. Yes, I think if we had this political environment back in the 70s, it would have been really hard to deal with mm-hmm. the issues with CFCs.
For sure.
It was hard to deal with to begin with.
Yes.
But now we seem to be in a situation where people just ignore science, and that we really can't do that. You can't just ignore data.
Exactly.
It's going to leave it to a problem.
It certainly is. And the whole global community came together for it.
And
for
that's true, too, right, because it was a global problem.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with global warming.
Now.
It's a global problem, and people need to get together and solve it.
Yeah. We did have a question from Wendy. She sent us an email. Many years ago, maybe 10 to 15, she had heard a report that Wisconsin weather would eventually be like Missouri, which I think we've heard that before. Is that what's happening now?
There was, I think it was about 10 to 15 years ago. And even now, although I don't see the map so much, in order to get the message across about what weather is going to be like due to global warming, they were looking at, okay, it's states to the south of us. Mm-hmm. What's their weather like? And so they would say, yeah, we're going to be, our average temperatures in wintertime are going to go up. We're not going to have as much snow. And therefore, we're going to look like this particular state. I think that was a good public message to get across.
Mm-hmm.
But the different, and the global warming is occurring, and maybe our mean temperature will be like Missouri. But the difference is geographically, we are different. And that will impact what our weather is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're bordered by two very large water bodies, Lake Superior and Lake Michigan. And that influences what our weather looks like. I think it's a good example to demonstrate to people, particularly if you don't like Missouri weather, which I don't, not during the summertime.
No, it's not.
Nothing against Missouri, but I don't like hot, humid weather.
Yeah,
And that's kind of where we're trending to. And we're seeing that now in the summertime up here. It mm-hmm. gets hot and humid.
Yes, for sure. Yeah. So that's kind of a little bit. But so we're having a few problems with our phone lines today, and I apologize to that. We had a whole new system put in last week. But I think we got them fixed now, so fingers crossed. You can always send us an email, too, if you're not being able to get through, and that's talk@wpr.org. Let's talk a little bit about Doppler radar, okay? So we all know about it getting precipitation and stuff, but it picks up other things, too, doesn't it?
It does, and it's really interesting when it does pick it up. Particularly for me personally, what I like is when the birds are migrating again.
Right.
And so in the evening, or bats as well, in the evenings when they're either coming in or early mornings when they're taking off, the radar can picks them up and you could actually see them.
Isn't that crazy?
Moving out. It's really crazy and interesting.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that's interesting to me anyway is, we have these sea breezes and lake breezes for us coming off of Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
And a lot of times on hot, humid days, when that lake breeze comes inland, it takes all that humidity and pushes it to the west. And you could see that lake breeze front on radar as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like my app, you can be doing like wind, or you can do in precipitation. Is that the Doppler doing that too?
There are Doppler winds, but those aren't really used for the precipitation type activity.
Okay.
They're being used more and more. They were originally used for radar, not radar, for research type of activities. But yeah, most of the, and so my guess is, what the apps, at least that I have seen, where you're looking at wind and wind predictions, those are for models situations. So they're taking current data and either forecasting or using that data to turn it into a wind map.
I would like to know how the first person who saw that, the birds on the radar, reacted to that.
I would imagine they would have said, what is that?
What is that? Oh, my God.
I mean, one of the things you can see in the Milwaukee radar, just north of it, there's a wind farm. And so on beautiful, clear days, you can see this radar signal from that wind farm.
Wow.
Now, they have methodologies to remove it, but it doesn't always work. And so some days you can look and you say, wow, why is it raining just there? And the answer is it's not. It's
not.
Just they got the windmills going and you can pick them up.
Oh, that's interesting. We did have a message from Christopher. He said, our climate disruption is changing weather patterns worldwide, and now we see it here at home. We need to triple down on reducing our greenhouse gas emissions and plant trees and grasses to absorb carbon. We can make the difference. We need to act now, and there is nothing to chuckle about here, and the August weather in October is not nice. Okay. Well, Christopher's not happy with us being happy with this weather.
Yeah. And I could see, the point he's making, which we talked a little bit with the ozone, is that we know that this is a problem. The data is showing that we are warming. And if we're going to do something about it, we have to do something as a society and a global society. We need to work together to figure out whether it's planting more trees. What the trees are doing, though, is storing it. So when the trees die, they're going to release it as well. So the question is, what are the activities that we need to do in order to kind of slow this down or stop it, if we can stop it?
And did I read right, too, that the warmer temperatures are melting like the ice caps, and that's releasing more carbon also?
And, that is a big issue now that we're really seeing that up on the ice sheets. I mean, for one, we've noticed that on the Great Lakes or in the local lakes here in Madison. The ice on time period is reduced. But what we're seeing now is the glaciers are melting. Their predictions on Greenland is covered with an ice sheet. Antarctica is covered with an ice sheet. And as those melt, we're seeing the Antarctic ice sheet melt away. If those continue to melt, there's a lot of land underneath there as well. And that land's going to come up. And again, that'll then also have impacts on the ocean circulations and the sea level height as well when all that land pushes up. So we got issues here that our great-grandchildren are going to have to be dealing with, and we need to try to find ways to
get them ready. What are some of your favorite sources for information on all this climate change?
I usually go right to NOAA. So the NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, does have climate sites that you can go and get climate data from.
Mm-hmm.
They're a very trustworthy organization to get not just current data, which I think a lot of people probably go after. National Weather Service is part of that. So if you're looking at radar data, again, that's kind of the areas where it's coming from. And so that's where I typically will go and deal their red maps.
Do you have
For weather climate in Wisconsin, I go to the Wisconsin State Climate Office. That's a lot faster data, and it's very specific for what's happening in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin
today.
State Climate Office.
Yeah.
Is that what they're, I mean, should we just Google it?
You can Google it, and, it'll come up. Steve Vavris is the director here at UW-Madison. And Ed Hopkins is my favorite go-to guy when I have a climate question or a weather question about Wisconsin. Just email him and just say, what's happening here?
Oh, that's nice to have him in your email list.
It is. And he's again, very good and knowledgeable. He's been around for a while.
Yeah. Again, I apologize. We are having phone problems, but we'd love to hear what your question or observation is. So maybe you can send us an email. That's talk@wpr.org. So there's always been this, I don't know if it's a myth or if it's true, but when it was thunderstorming out and I want to take a shower, my mom's like, no, do not take a shower during a thunderstorm. Is that a myth or is that something we should be concerned about?
It's a little bit of both.
Okay.
Before I go into the explanation, I will say this, even though I know my house pretty well, when it's thunderstorming out, I'm not going to take a shower. No. Now, the probability of getting hit, I mean, the issue back when our grandparents were telling us this,
yes,
is there were a lot of pipes, metal pipes, copper pipes. And it was possible that the house gets struck, even though it's unlikely, mm-hmm. Probability is low. If it does, then it can travel around through those pipes in the house. And if you're nearby, you can get hit, you know, as a secondary effect.
Yeah.
Whether or not it would kill you, maybe not, but you would get a really nasty shock. Today's modern houses, they don't use so much copper anymore because it's expensive, and mm-hmm. so they have plastic. And so, you know, again, the probability is less than. The probability has also gone down, I think, because when I was growing up, when you had a wanted to watch TV and get a good signal, you needed to have an antenna on your house, and that was made of metal as well.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, everybody had one in the neighborhood, and so which house it would hit or which antenna, you know, again, there's a fraction of chance there.
Right. Same thing with phone lines, right?
And phone lines as well. Anything in metal, I mean, it can do it. When I was teaching, I had a student in class when we were talking about lightning. And him and his granddad were laying fence, which means they were putting down barbed wire, fencer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, they could hear thunder, but it was way off. And the next thing he knew, him and his granddad were on the ground. They got knocked out. And what they concluded, and they were okay, but what they concluded is, you know, it hit the barbed wire fence a mile away, and it just traveled down the fence, and they were holding it, and it's happened.
Wow, the chances of that.
The chances of that are small, but mm-hmm. Speaking of small chances, have a tree that we have to take down because it has some fungus, and it's a cottonwood tree, and it may spread to the other ones, you know, so it was like, okay, we got to take this down. It's scheduled to come down sometime in November, but about a month ago, it got hit by lightning.
Wow.
Now it's still standing, and I was at, you know, the window looking out at the storm when it got hit. And boy, I'll tell you, you know, if you haven't had lightning bolts hit close to you, boy, was that a noise and a power. And it,
yes,
you know, it exploded part of the tree. The tree's still together, but you really see the power in those lightning bolts.
Yeah, it's scary when it hits. And then it's like, they say it's ozone in the air. Is that what it is?
You get a smell like that, yes, that it gets equated to it. Mm-hmm. I didn't go outside. You know,
probably
I was
wise
just like,
on your part.
I was shocked about two things. One is that it hit the tree while I was looking. And of all the cottonwoods, it hit the one that we had to take down anyway. So,
someone up there likes you.
Somebody, right, yes.
Maybe. I don't know. Or their aim is off. One of the two.
Right.
Dean emailed us. He said, if you're missing winter, winter is coming tomorrow to him in Colorado. His question is about Milton, the hurricane, I'm assuming. Have you ever seen a hurricane develop in the Western Caribbean Sea and go northeast? What happened to hurricanes forming in the easterly waves from Africa and moving west with easterly waves?
Yeah, I didn't really track Milton. As he's pointing out, easterly waves are waves that travel around the globe in the tropical regions,
mm-hmm.
and hurricanes form in those areas and are also follow the transportation of those waves because of the divergence upper levels that allows the hurricane to develop. But I'm not sure where Milton went. So sorry about that.
Yeah. So with the global weather changes, what does that mean for big storms like the ones we just saw?
That is a really good question. What we're seeing in the big storms, there are two things that come to my mind. One is the the hurricanes, the tropical storms as well. What we're seeing in the terms of rapid intensification, which we've seen with some of these storms, particularly the recent ones that got to Florida and North Carolina, the water, one of the keys you need is to have warm water. Sea surface temperatures are warm, and we certainly have that with global warming, and that's allowing them to develop quicker. Because the other thing is, it's just not the surface water that needs to be warm. In these situations, the depth of that warmth is getting to depth, so that as the storm develops and the winds pick up and begin to mix that water up, it's not pulling down cooler water from below. It's still pulling up that 26.5 degree temperatures as well that help feed the hurricane.
And with, like, the Gulf Stream getting warmer, is that going to mean possibly that hurricanes are going to be hitting further up north?
We still get hurricanes up north, for sure, or they break down and become extratropical storms and get pretty nice, pretty neat, mean. The question, I think, with the Gulf Stream goes back to Greenland. As that ice sheet melts, you know, it's feeding into where the Gulf Stream goes. And so what will happen to the Gulf Stream is that water, cold water, comes in. And how does that change its path? And will that affect the path of the of storms that might follow normally along the Gulf Stream?
Sure. Yeah. Let's see. I'm not getting any emails, people. If you've got any questions, give us a call. Oh, don't give us a call. It's not working.
That's right.
But send us an email, talk@wpr.org. What else
The other thing with regard to storms and global warming, that this would be a question for John because it's his area of expertise, is these mid-latitude cyclones, these winter storms.
Right.
And so part of those winter storms is they're trying to erase these temperature gradients between the north and the south. And so as we warm up, those temperature gradients are going to go further north. So how that affects the development of these mid-latitude cyclones that we get, I'm not sure about, but John would know when it could be a question for next month.
For next time, because he's obviously not coming now. So
something's kind of, I'm a little worried about it.
Thanks, but, John. So I think next time you should probably just not show up, Steve.
That's right.
Well, you know, something I'm always curious about is rain gauges. So how accurate are they, and where do you put them so that you know that you're getting an accurate reading?
So two aspects to this. One is I want to plug this group called COCHRAS, which is COCHRAS or something. It's a community group that does rainfall measurements. And so they have a recommended rain gauge that you get, and you put it out. The main thing is you want to make sure you put it away from any obstructions that might block rain from falling on it, or from bouncing off something and getting into the rain gauge. So you got to make sure it's nice and big and open. And those rain gauges are very accurate. They've been around for a very, very, very hundreds of years, 100 years anyway. And so that's an accurate measurement of it. Again, depending on where you put it, for sure. And I've been doing that now for several years, probably a decade or more. I don't do it in the wintertime. Because you get rain in there, it's likely to freeze, and they're made of plastic, so they crack. There they also have a process on how you measure a snowfall. So again, there you want a very flat surface that's in the open, but not too shielded a little bit so the winds don't just take it away. And you make snow depth measurements in multiple places to do that.
Okay.
Now, there are a variety of also weather stations that you can buy from different organizations. One of them is La Crosse. That's the brand name. And I think it's made in Wisconsin. And so I got that. I had an older one that didn't measure rain, or it didn't measure it very well. And I ran my boat into it and broke it. So I had to get a new one.
and put it
in a better spot.
I take it you were backing up your boat?
I was backing up and not paying attention. I was like,
do you live on a lake? I was confused there, Steve.
And that actually has, it's called the dipping gauge. So it falls into this little gathering bucket and falls into this cup. And when that cup gets full, it tips over, empties out, and another cup moves in. And they've calibrated it so that each time that cup tips, it's a certain amount of precipitation.
Okay.
And so I put that right next to my, near my rain gauge, my manual rain gauge. Mm-hmm. And actually the two of them, to my surprise, are actually really accurate.
Okay.
Often less than, differences are generally often less than a tenth of a degree, you know, like 0.05 or something. So
those,
if you don't want to go out and make the measurement all the time, a good weather station with a good rain gauge will also do it. And then it beams it right back to your house.
Nice.
So you can read it in your living room.
Yeah, because you don't want to go out when it's raining or snowing.
Right, yes. If you're participating in Kokoros at 7 a.m., you need to go out there and make that measurement.
Okay. David in Sherwood emailed, as a cyclist, he would love to dial in a nice tailwind while planning his route. And he's curious about prevailing wind directions, how Lake Michigan impacts wind, and any hints about the best time of day or season to ride when touring.
Boy, that's a good question. I don't have any input on the best time or season. I think around the big lakes, like Lake Michigan, the things you want to watch for are lake breezes. And so those are pretty well forecast in the summertime in particular. When they'll break out, they usually happen late in the afternoon, and they'll blow from the lake inland. And so you can have a good chance of having a tailwind that way. Now, how far they go, maybe 70 miles. So if he's a real... into biking, that might not be long enough for him.
depends on the day, I would assume.
It depends on the day and where their wind direction is coming from.
Right, right.
But the National Weather Service is actually getting really good at its weather forecastings in general, and particular wind speed and directions. And so if I really want to know what the wind speed and direction is going to be because I'm going to row, I'm not a big biker, then, yeah, I'll go to their site, and they're actually pretty accurate.
Okay.
And actually, there are apps now on your phone, because I did this on the rowing again. You know, you could put in the conditions that you want, what weather, you know, obviously not rain for me, you know, what the temperature is, and in rowing, it's more of what is the wind speed and what is the direction. And it'll get the National Weather Service data and tell you, you know, in the coming day, what are the good times to go out and do rowing based on those conditions that you have?
That's so nice. Which app is that?
I don't remember what it is.
Well, thanks for the information.
I've had it for so long, right? You just open it up and look.
And there it is, right? Yeah, yeah. It's like phone numbers.
Yeah, right.
Well, it's out there, so.
It's out there. Yeah, you know what? As we look at the next caller here, I'll
look at what it is. Lee emailed us in to ask, are there any consequences about the North Atlantic current and the possibility that it might be slowing or stopping in the next century or less?
The app, I think, is the Weather Underground app that'll do that.
The Weather Underground app.
The Weather Underground app.
Oh, that's really cool.
That.
Okay. Yeah. Got that.
Yeah, and I think, again, with regard to the Atlantic current, a lot of that prediction, again, is one, do we need the data to actually do it? I think we understand the physics of the circulations of the oceans pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
The main issue with how that's going to change in the future is associated with the ice pack. And here I'm not just talking about Greenland, but the Arctic ice sheet as well. As that melts, that's going to change the Arctic current, and we'll see the Gulf Stream current and where that's going.
Okay. Jeremiah sent us an email. Any new research on sprites from lightning in the upper atmosphere?
Yeah, so sprites, I'm sure there are. Sprites, for those who may not know, there are a lot of interesting things associated with lightning, with thunderstorms. And sprites are these things that will shoot out the top. And so if you're underneath the thunderstorm, you're probably not going to see them because they're shooting out the top and heading up out of space, sort of, or into the upper atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not aware of any new research that has occurred. And again, that's not because it's not happening. I'm just not sure what it is. I will say this, there's a lot of good satellites that better capabilities are up there. So I'm sure we're collecting more data on when sprites occur and how high they go.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's probably some
Yeah, I've never heard of that term before, so that's great. We are talking weather with John Ackerman, an emeritus professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. If you've got a question, send it to us at talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and we're talking about weather. I've been told that the phones are now working, so we have about 10 minutes left where we can maybe get your call. That's 800-642-1234. And just to let you know, we have lots of fun Halloween stuff coming up on the show this week. Wednesday, we're going to take a look at what nature does best in the dark. And then on Thursday, it's time to talk about the history of Halloween and the history of horror at the movies. So right now, like I said, we're talking weather, so let us know if you have any questions. Deb in Wausau emailed us. She's looking for clarification on your comments on weather modification and cloud seeding. She sent a few peer review articles about cloud seeding to enhance precipitation.
Yeah, so this again was a big thing in the 70s and the 80s as we began to understand more about what causes precipitation, particularly snowfall, that there was this idea that in order to get clouds form, you need nuclei. You need things for the water vapor to condense onto. And so the idea was, well, if we can put in the right kind of particles, we can help a cloud form. Or once a cloud forms, in order to get precipitation, you need some big particles in there so that they can collide with the other ones and then fall out. So the other question was, can we put bigger particles in there? And one way to do that was to put ice nuclei in there to, again, to enhance the seeding and to make the precipitation. There was a lot of research going on in the 70s and the 80s. I don't think there's much research going on right now because, again, I think as we collected data, we began to realize these systems are really, really big. And there's a lot of energy in there, and the little things that we can do really aren't going to work. Now, having said that, in the late 70s, I was at Colorado State doing some work there, and the ski slopes were very interested in generating more snowfall. And so they had a whole seeding program where they would put silver iodide into the clouds, hoping that that would lead to more snowfall. And so there was a big experiment to do that. They randomly would seed clouds on particular days and then measure snowfall afterwards. And after they did that for a couple of years and they did the analysis, sure enough, it turned out that snowfall did increase on the days that they seeded, which was a really big finding because now it's like, okay, this is really going to help ski resorts. A couple of years later, somebody reanalyzed the data and they said, yes, that was true, except the days in which they did seed, it just so happened, and again, this was all random, that the winds were upslope. So the winds were coming upslope anyway, and upslope winds are going to generate more snowfall than other kinds of winds. Mm-hmm. And so when they randomized and took that effect out, then there wasn't any impact at all.
Okay.
It was kind of an interesting thing because it was a really big thing in the late 70s, and then all of a sudden it was like, oh, wait a minute, that... It goes back to, again, what do we know and what do we don't know?
Sure. Let's go to Bob in Clay Banks. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, Dylan, Steve. Thanks for having the show. Steve, I've got two thermometers. One's the old red liquid ones, and the other is a La Crosse. And I put the sensor for the La Crosse on the north side of my garage, and the red liquid one is just outside a window on the north side of the house. And we get different readings, and sometimes it's kind of strange because sometimes the La Crosse will show things warmer than the other one, and it's, you know, kind of like a stand on the north side of the house. So,
yeah, you know, it's funny you should bring that up because I have the same problem, and I have a La Crosse system. I put my thermometer on. Out by my rain gauge, because I wanted to have the rain gauge measurement out there as well. And I put it in the facing north. And what I noticed in the summertime is that the temperature would all of a sudden increase. as we were approaching sunset. And what was happening, I'm pretty sure, is that the way that I had it, even though I thought it was very well protected, the sun was hitting it at certain points. And that just shot the temperature up. And then when the sun moved a little bit further, an hour later, the temperature would come back down. So my plan, and I haven't done this yet, is to put a shield on that west-facing side so that I can assure that it's in shadow all the time. So you might look at that, see where the sun is. If your thermometer is always warmer than there all day long, then there's something else that's going on.
Could be a reflection off of something, too.
It might be. But again, I would think that that would be then associated with where the position of the sun is in order to get that solar energy on it. So I'm hoping that's what it is, because if it's not, then again, even though I keep basically saying the La Crosse system's really good, then maybe the thermometer's not.
Yeah. Okay, Bob, good luck. Russ in Belleville, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. First, a disclaimer, I'm not a climate denier, but I remember a few years ago I read something where someone had a theory that you would have a period of warming before you had an ice age, and that would warm and melt the ice, shut off the Gulf Stream up, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere, and that would be how an ice age initiated. What do you think about that process?
Yeah, you know, there were a lot of good theories, and again, this goes back to the current of the Gulf Stream and what's going to happen when that ice sheet melts. It's definitely going to change the Gulf Stream. What it's going to do, I think there's modeling theories about what that's going to happen. And I'm guessing in the past, the position of that Gulf Stream was very much associated with how much ice we had on the globe and whether or not it was an ice age or not. I don't think that's going to be applicable to current situations, primarily because of the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the general global warming that we're seeing. What I think we're really going to see the impact is downstream of the Gulf Stream. So those countries downstream that are really keeping have weather advantages, if you want to think of it in terms of more milder weather because of the Gulf Stream. If that moves, what will happen to them? Will they get more variability in their rain, more weather? That part I don't know.
And you're talking about states like Carolinas?
No. So further down, different countries. So
that far down.
Yeah, so like Norway, areas like that, where the Gulf Stream is really helping moderate their weather.
All right. Thank you for that question, Russ. Yeah, Tammy called but couldn't stay with us. Could you describe how the UV index is measured, and why is a UV index of 1 or 2 still pretty sunny?
So I don't know the details. What the UV index is telling us is how much ultraviolet radiation is down at the surface, and that'll be a function primarily of cloud cover, also time of day as well. I don't remember if a low UV index is good or a high UV index is bad. I would think a high UV index is not as good as a low, and I say that not as somebody who wants to have a tan,
but he does, by the way.
It's because a lot of people who have very fair skin and ultraviolet radiation, particularly if they were younger and they didn't put protective coatings on their skin, are now dealing with skin cancer as well. So it wouldn't surprise me, even in a cloudy condition, you could have higher UVs or moderate UV indexes, and that's because the clouds, if they're thin, are just going to scatter the radiation. They're not going to absorb it, and that scattering will illuminate potentially more areas than just the direct beam from the sun.
Okay. Real quick question before we have to go. Lorraine in Green Bay is looking for a good, reliable weather station for her husband for Christmas. Hope he's not listening. One that he could connect to Weather Underground. Any ideas?
I would go to the Weather Underground site and see if they have recommendations. As I say, I have the La Crosse system. It seems to work really well. I don't remember what the price ranges are. But there are a number of good companies now that make good rain gauges. And I think the big part is where you're going to put it.
there you go.
Make sure it's in a good spot and you're not going to run into it and break it.
That's right. words of wisdom. Thank you so much, Steve, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Steve Ackerman is the former Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. We thank him for being with us. I want to thank our team today, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, and our usual host, of course, Larry Mueller. I'm executive producer Jill Nadeau. I really appreciate you being with us today. Enjoy the rest of it.